Idiots, you bloody cobbers. This is Jeff Phillips sitting here by the campfire in the backyard in north central Tasmania. It's the late morning of Saturday, the 27th of June, 2020. It was quite below freezing this morning. There was a bit of ice, and so I built a little fire out here in the backyard. And it's interesting that Australia, especially in the past year, has really been associated with fires. So this is a campfire, and I'm in Tasmania, which is a very sort of wintry Tasmanian thing to do. We were able to do that at beautiful Mount William National Park last weekend when we went there for the winter solstice and the solar eclipse and a whole lot of really cosmic stuff that's still going on right now. I'm sitting here outside, and you're probably going to hear some birds, a beautiful little, like a little honey eater. Somebody just came and jumped on the bush next to me. I'm sitting here with my little family of plants, my flowers, my pansies, my replanted celery and carrots and beetroot from when we've harvested for juice. I replant them in the soil, beautiful volcanic Tasmanian soil. My family of creatures here, Teddy, Wally, Ruby Ann, Big Teddy, Heidi, Phil, Huckleberry, Ellie, Kylie and Peter. Oh, Webbyups, we love Tasmania. We love to be here. And I'm going to interview them on the show again soon. But we're so lucky to be here. This show is On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 327. About celebrating 20 years that I've been traveling in Australia. On the 1st of July, it'll be 20 years since I very first set foot here in this lifetime. In the past few years, I've started to realize that I think I might actually be from here originally a long time ago. It's very interesting that when I was interviewing a woman named Stella Wheeldon a few years ago, she knows a lot about Aboriginal astronomy, and she was kind of an initiated adopted daughter of Auntie Millie Boyd, who was a Bundjalung elder near Wollumbin or Mount Warning. Anyway, Stella said that one day Auntie Millie Boyd, she was a totally initiated elder woman, told Stella that their belief was that a long time before there was black people in Australia, there was people with blonde hair and blue eyes. And if that had come from anybody else, I probably would have just blown it off as a conjecture. But she was a very top elder of a whole nation. So that's very interesting, but it really resonates with me and helps me understand my extraordinarily deep connection I have with Australia, no matter where I go, whether I've been there or not before in this lifetime. I feel like I know the place. I feel like it's my home. I feel like it's where I belong, and I've been so lucky. I mean, if you asked me in 2000 if I was still going to be here 20 years from now, I would have gone, it's impossible to think that far ahead. You can, but to gauge what you might be doing in 20 years is practically impossible, especially in the world of today. But it's just been miracle after miracle after miracle after extraordinarily cool, impossible stuff that keeps happening year after year after year. And it keeps taking me to the next level. And I remember back in the early years, I met a guy named Brett Green. He's kind of an amateur sort of archaeologist living near Gympie. And I was asking him about, how there's all these places I want to go, like Uluru and every place out west that at that time seemed light years away. And I go, like, well, look, how can I know where I'm really supposed to go? And Brett said, well, look, don't worry about it. The land will bring you around itself, herself, to where you're supposed to be. And so I've really seen that to be really, really, really true. And I think of Australia as the most powerful environmental, spiritual environment, place, sacred land in the whole planet. And every place is special and sacred and powerful in its own way, every square centimeter. But there are certain places that have, every place has a unique energy, like volcanoes and islands and places. But here, Australia, we're talking about some land that's some of the oldest crust surface of the earth that you can access on the whole earth. The only place I know that might be older at the surface is Greenland. but that's basically under an ice sheet. So Australia has some of the oldest land that you can just go and walk on that's literally been there for billions of years, relatively unchanged because of the dry and stable climate here across most of the continent. That's why Australia also has many, many dozens of impact craters from meteors, comets, and asteroids that span hundreds of millions, if not billions of years. And a lot of these are actually visible and accessible, and they haven't been eroded or covered over like they have been on almost every other continent, or they're not covered by ice like they would be in Antarctica. So you can get away from places here, drive and get out and walk, especially in Western Australia. You can relatively easy get to a location where it's possible that you might stand on some earth that has never been stood on or touched by human beings, even the indigenous people from here. It's that big and old of a place. And there's a place, one of my very favorite nature places that I hope to make it to within the next few weeks. And it's in the Pilbara. It's called Karajini National Park. That's K-A-R-I-J-I-N-I. Karajini National Park. And it's got a dozen or two really deep gorges. Not deep by the standards of the Grand Canyon, but hundreds of meters deep. And the characteristic look is that you see these kind of, it looks like stacks of pancakes when you go down in there. And what it is, it's called banded iron formations made by the cyanobacteria as they digested or processed the iron and created these layers. And the earth is relatively, the tectonics have been so stable there over a couple of billion years that the earth hasn't shifted or moved. The only thing that's happened is the rivers have worn down through there and cut these gorges. But you can literally look back. I mean, the rivers might be down at a level that's literally billions of years old when you look at those layers that you can see down there. So, I mean, where else on the earth can you go and just be with that? But the people of Australia, all this stuff is pretty much invisible to almost everybody. And that's a whole complex psychological dynamic in itself. But Lisbon and I, my partner of 5 years, we traveled all over Australia and New Zealand comprehensively, primarily by hitchhiking. And a really cool special place would come on our radar. Somebody would tell us about a place they've been, and we'd see photographs. We'd go, like, oh, my God, we've got to go there. And sometimes it might have taken us 2 or 3 years of planning and being in the right place at the right time and lining everything up. And we'd be hitchhiking there to this mountain or something, and we'd get a ride with people that live close to there. And we'd go, like, oh, my God, it's taken us 3 years to get here. We're so excited. And, you know, and so how often have you guys gone to, you know, Mount Augustus or something like that, and they'd go like, oh yeah, well, we'll get there one day. And I go like, what? It's just unbelievable. People might live within 30 kilometers of one of the most beautiful, spectacular, sacred, amazing places in the whole continent, and yet they've never gone. Not because they aren't interested, but just because they really aren't interested, because if they were, they'd go. It's because they can, they never do. But on the other hand, along the lines of what Brett Green was saying, the earth brings you where you're supposed to be. And so when a lot of people don't go to these places, it could be that they're not really meant to go there. You know, in kind of a darkly humorous way, that's the only good thing I can think of about cities, is that the people that live in cities want to be there as opposed to out in the country or out in nature. And it's a good place for them. It's like a roach hotel where the insects can go and live in a colony, and they can be happy, and they can leave when they want to, but they just don't. You know, I personally cannot. I've never identified with cities, but now less than ever. And it's just, you know, so bless their hearts. I'm not saying that there's too many people on the earth. There's plenty, but the number of people is not the problem. It's the quality of the people, or how many people still actually qualify as people in terms of what it's traditionally meant to be people. But the indigenous people of Australia, who are a very amazing, beautiful, lovely, gentle people, I've met the elders of several dozen of the nations. I don't use the word tribe. They don't really like the word Aboriginal. That's actually Latin. It means from the beginning. But they like to be called First Nations or even just people. You know, the people of Australia, the real people. But people ask me what brought me down under, and I go like, well, Air New Zealand. And they go like, ah, but which is really true. Still my favorite airline. Fly Air New Zealand today. They still exist. I really feel that it has to do with my connection with the dolphins. It goes back in this lifetime to the late 70s. But around 1990, I started feeling a very powerful call to come to Australia. I wasn't really sure exactly why. Didn't know anybody here. I've seen advertisements for Foster's Beer, Crocodile Dundee. I knew what a kangaroo was, crocodile. Probably seen pictures of Uluru. I knew there was the indigenous people here, but I felt a really powerful connection with them. And a friend of mine had a book of some Aboriginal art, and it's like it was talking to me. Not literally, but it's like this energy was coming through it. And then this was, I think it was the cover of a book. It had a painting by an artist from the Central Desert, Pitjantjatjara, I believe, named Clifford Possum. And I loved that art. But then I learned a few years ago that what a lot of people think is the dot art that's a uniquely Australian Indigenous person's art. Actually, that whole style of painting only originated in the 1970s due to the work of a Sydney lawyer named Geoffrey Barton, who came and lived at a community called Papunya, and he got the people there who were all shoved together from many different groups in an artificial environment where they couldn't really do anything. They couldn't practice their traditional way. They were bored. So he got them to start painting. He had art supplies. He gave them ideas to paint. And sure, art has existed in the indigenous culture. We've got the more rock art than anywhere else on Earth, especially out in the Kimberley, in the Dampier Archipelago, for example, near Port Hedland. There's over 3 million known petroglyphs, according to my friend Robert Bednarik, who I've interviewed on the show before, a top rock art researcher. But the Bradshaw rock art and the Wangunas, and the Guion in the Kimberley, there's many, many, many thousands. I mean, I hope to visit there on this trip for the first time. But so the rock art and bark painting and maybe painting in sand and stuff as part of a storytelling or ceremonial stuff, that's existed in body painting. But the dot painting that people think is Australian, it only originated in the 70s as a response to what was created at Papunya. And it became exported and then all different kind of stuff like that. And so some of the first full-blooded indigenous Australian I met, her name was Kathleen Wallace. She's the leader of the Kuringi artist group at Aranda. They're Aranda people just south of Alice Springs in the Central Desert, and I met them in 2003. And they were blown away that I, not only that they love my art, because I was sent to them because a guy with an art gallery in Alice saw my rocks, and he goes like, Jeff, you got to go see the Kuringi artists. You're doing the same thing. And I'd never seen their art before. And it's like mine was different, but similar. And so they love my art. They couldn't believe I used the brush, where they use these little batiking bottles. But anyway, they gave me a copy of their book. And then I made a really cool set of rocks and sent to them, a big one and 13 small ones. It has this a sort of a whole new style of painting. I call them the MK glyphs, Mullum Kuringi glyphs, because it was had to do with a vision that I saw when I was sitting on the ground near the Wollumbin or Mount Warning volcano in 2000. This pattern, I started seeing it with my eyes closed for the very first time, and it started showing up in my painting. And so I did this big rock and sent it to a whole set of rocks for Kathleen Wallace and the Kuringi artists. And then later on, I was looking at that book and I go, oh my God, there was a little kind of a dot-like painting that Serena Hayes had done that was almost identical to a painting I had done just using some circles of dots, but in shades of green, colors that the indigenous Australians rarely, if ever, use. After I had gone to a sacred old-growth forest in western North Carolina called Joyce Kilmer on the summer solstice of 1999. We almost did the exact same painting, and so the connection's been there. And I felt like that some indigenous elders were putting out a call for anyone around the world that could hear and respond to their call for people to come down here who might be able to pick up on this ancient sacred connection with life, water-based life that might exist elsewhere in other star systems, that the indigenous people here and their connection with the whales and dolphins has been maintaining this connection more powerfully and for longer than any other human culture. And this is something that Dr. John Lilly talked about, that the whales and dolphins were actually repeater stations for water-based life on other planets, and that they're maintaining the connection. And so the indigenous people here, especially the whale-dreaming people, with whom I've become very deeply embraced since around 2014 up in the Central Coast, this is part of my story of Australia. And I've been blessed with trying to carry the torch and the mission of the indigenous people and to maintain this sacred connection, to sing the song lines and traverse the song lines and create new ones and bring forth what Barbara Randall, wife, widow of Uncle Bob Randall, one of the custodians of Uluru, she told me I was bringing forth painting, the new dreaming. And I really feel that. It's like as we hopefully return to a golden age after the Kali Yuga, it's like we're spiraling back around to where we've been before, but at another level. So things repeat, but they don't. The universe is creative, and we're part of a vast, intelligent universe, a vast creative process. And we're right in the middle of it right here. One of my most important series of paintings is called The Chakras of the Rainbow Serpent, and I depict Australia. I depict the rainbow serpent as a continental geotelluric energy being whose chakras correspond to specific landforms on the continent, beginning with Uluru, Wilpena Pound, Valley of the Giants down near Denmark, Western Australia, Karajini, Kakadu on the top end, Wollumbin, Nimbin, and Goonangarri, the volcano, Garry Word National Park, and then Tasmania is the crown chakra of the rainbow serpent, and that's where I've been for the past 3 months. And I'm doing my most elaborate medicine wheel here before I head off in the next 2 or 3 weeks and continue my healing expedition that's going to take me, hopefully in this order, to the William Ricketts Sanctuary, to Kata or Kangaroo Island, to Flinders Ranges, Wilpena Pound, Uluru in the Central Desert, the top end, Darwin, Litchfield, Nipmuluk, Kakadu, Pernalulu, El Questro, the Guion, Karajini, maybe the Kennedy Ranges in Mount Augustus for the first time, the Wangina Rock Art, Cape Range, Exmouth, Valley of the Giants down in near Denmark, across the Australian Bight up to Mount Yanga, the very sacred mountain I visited 3 times last year. Oh my God. And see, ever since the fires that happened back in December and January, that same scenario could easily repeat this year, and it's going to be extraordinarily horrific if... Well, think of this. What if a horrific fire situation happens like last year, only in the middle of some kind of weird lockdown scenario because of the coronavirus thing? Too horrific to think about. So on July 1st, it'll be 20 years that I've been traveling. Bureaucratically, I'm a tourist. I've never tried to get residency, and I can see the wisdom behind that now. I'm able to be moved to be in the right place at the right time, and I've seen that in operation. My beautiful guardian angels and guiding divas and spirits and everything from the highest level of guidance literally putting me in the right place at the right time, especially more now more than ever for the past year or two. My visit to Australia 2 years ago, my visit to New Zealand and Australia last year, and then being here in Tasmania now, and getting ready to be mobile again for a while. But so, I've, I when I came down under, I went to New Zealand first and just started doing the same life I had done in America all through the 80s and 90s, hitchhiking around everywhere, meeting really cool people, giving away painted rocks, doing artwork and stuff, and just kind of being a human RNA messenger molecule and freelance intelligence agent working on behalf of Mother Nature to try to share information and inspire people to love Mother Earth and to act on it, not just talk about it. So I really just kind of stepped right into my same life down under. And really, the culture of New Zealand and Australia is practically no different from America or Canada. And in fact, the relationship between New Zealand and Australia is very much like the relationship between Canada and the USA. Just really the same culture, just a slight difference in mentality, slight difference in accent, really the same thing. And all four of those countries are really pretty much the same thing, just in different hemispheres. So I would say that I've learned and come to the same conclusions after 20 years of hitchhiking all around North America, 150,000 miles in 47 states, and I probably hitched that much more, if not more, all over Australia and New Zealand comprehensively. I know I've hitched well over 400,000 kilometers since 1981. I've gone to the moon and about halfway back. And I hope to do more hitchhiking. But I've learned, just like I did in America, like that the real world, when you get out there in it, the more you get out there in it and expose yourself to the unknown and to people you've never met and situations and stuff, the more I saw that the real world is actually a very friendly and nice place in terms of the people, and that the outside world is portrayed, like on the news and mass media, was radically different. The world as portrayed on mass media is a vicious, vile, negative, violent, and destructive place. But the world that I lived in America, was not like that at all. And I'd say the same for down under. It's, you know, I know the real world. What could be realer than hitchhiking in a country that you aren't even a resident in, and going places you've never been? I mean, you know, the fact that nothing bad ever happened to me. In fact, only really good stuff. And the one instance of that seemed like the worst case scenario happened here in Tasmania in 2001, but it ended up being the coolest, most powerful thing that's ever happened to me. I wrote that up as a story called The Ghoulest and the Coolest. So there you go. There's an expression, leap and the net will appear, and I think it's a good idea if you can at least probably see the net before you leap. You know, so I would qualify that kind of way. But I love Australia. It's a very amazing place. But it's a land of extremely diverse geography and geology. It's a geologist's paradise, probably for the same reason I was talking about, because the surface minerals and stuff are so easily accessible as to be, they're defenseless. That's part of one of the dark sides of Australia, is that because it's so easy to get at everything, and the indigenous people and the native plants and animals didn't evolve to need defenses against predators like they did in Europe or in the Americas. So they're not so fast. They're not so thorny. And there are, you know, Australia does have plenty of things with venom, like it's known for its poisonous snakes and spiders. So that's a way of protection and stuff like that. But in general, it was a peaceful environment, tranquil, isolated from the more, I won't say it's not a dynamic place, but it's been more kind of tranquil in its evolution with plenty of time. It's just such a magic place, but it's a land of very extraordinarily vast contradiction, because I think the indigenous people here were the truest indigenous people that the earth has ever seen, and just as spiritual and highly evolved culturally as any people from India. But when the British came here, it was especially Joseph Banks, who was the wealthy friend of the British nobility, and I think he was a botanist that came with James Cook. But when he came to Australia, it was him who looked on the beautiful indigenous people, and he declared Australia to be a land of terra nullius. There was nothing here. And it was so, that's where that came from. And also, he gave the Crown the idea of shipping their worst criminally psychotic prisoners down here to transport them to create a penal colony. So Joseph Banks and Captain Cook have a lot to answer for in terms of what's happened down under. So Australia has a lot of racism. And being, now I don't really refer to myself as being white, and I'm not. I mean, white is a piece of paper, or a cloud, or a refrigerator, or a snowbank. I've never seen a person that color, not even Edgar or Johnny Winter, the albinos. Nobody's white. And so I have seen black people that are close to being black, much closer than I have to seeing a white person that's white. So this whole thing with colors of lives that matter, it's just more complete bullshit. But Australia does have a lot of racism, and being a quote-unquote white person, I haven't been exposed to it as much as it is there, but I've seen it, and I know about it. And what has happened to the indigenous people here is probably the worst genocidal destructiveness on the whole planet. Maybe not in terms of the sheer numbers of people, but in terms of the brutality and the fact of who they are and the spiritual culture that they had before the white man came. And this is where the work of sculptor William Ricketts really figures heavily in an understanding of Australia and honoring the real people, because he became a sculptor to create very lifelike sculptures of the real people that lived in the central desert, Arundun Pitjantjatjara, who he lived with off and on for 30 years. He created sculptures with the faces of real people he knew, and his goal was to show white Australia how beautiful and spiritually evolved these people are. They look like angels from the Garden of Eden, and I'm helping director Paul Bennett to make a film about the William Ricketts Sanctuary. It's located in the Dandenongs, which is about an hour and a half southeast of Melbourne. Very amazing place. I hope to visit there whenever I leave Tasmania in 2 or 3 weeks. But there's a certain man there with a very interestingly shaped head. He's obviously one of the high-level medicine men or shamans. But I actually feel, because he's Aranda from the central desert where Kathleen Wallace is from, I really feel that it was him who called me down under. And maybe not me specifically, but it was his call to the world that I heard and responded to. And so this is just all part of the unbelievable story of my being here. So Australia has it's one of the most dangerous countries environmentally in terms of how rapidly it's being destroyed. And the mining industry, more than anywhere else in the world, is just running out of control. And the coal industry controls Australia in the same way that the fishing industry controls New Zealand. And they're just, you know, continuing to create some of the hugest mining operations on the planet. The Carmichael Adani thing is going ahead up in Queensland. Some of the mine sites out in Western Australia. I mean, I haven't been there in 10 years, and I'll be going there this time, but I'm probably going to be blown away. It's at night when you can really tell, because the mine sites are lit up at night, and so in an area that's completely dark, you see the lights on the horizon. And even between the second and third time that I hitchhiked down from Darwin to Perth, between 2007 and 2010, I saw a great increase in the amount of lights, and so who knows what it's going to be like this time. But there, some of these places are just—they're unbelievably big. I mean, they would be bigger than like Melbourne or Los Angeles. But it's a giant. It's like a machine. There's an island called—I forget the name of the island now—but it's off of Western Australia, and it's got the largest. Oh, it's called Barrow Island, B-A-R-R-O-W. It's got the Chevron Gorgon Gas Project, which is like the largest industrial facility in the Southern Hemisphere. It's a whole island that's covered with all this stuff. And now, Rio Tinto or BHP or one of these giant mining companies is legally allowed to blow up over 40 sacred Aboriginal sites in Western Australia. And so this is just so horrific. This is like a blow to Mother Earth, to all people, to the entire relationship of humanity with the indigenous people, the ancient cultures and stuff. And it's not even about the actual physical destruction as it is the spiritual desecration of what it means. It's like they wanted, it's like they're trying to drive a stake and destroy the remaining spirit of not only just the indigenous people, but what it means, the connection with life. It's like literally, there is like a, what Claudia von Wurloff calls a hatred of life that characterizes the Western civilization's attitude towards nature and indigenous people and our family of life, our fellow beings. And you see that really at work. You see it at work big time. Australia's got a tremendous amount of influence from the U.S. military here. Probably 40 different kind of de facto American military installations. And the first truly prima facie American military base near kind of south of Darwin has been built a few years ago. But you've got the Pine Gap electronic warfare installation that's basically underground near Alice Springs. You've got the Harold E. Holt giant ELF antenna installation at Exmouth. You've got a lot of other different, you've got a thing called Jindalee. You've got all different kind of electronic warfare installations, kind of like Sisters of Harp. And it's very interesting that one of the leading corporations on the planet, up there with Lockheed in terms of being a manufacturer of weapons and specializing in the high-tech electronic microwave-based stuff, is a company called Raytheon. Raytheon actually owns the patents that make HARP possible. They have a major presence in Antarctica. They have a major presence in New Zealand. But about 3 or 4 years ago, the Australian government sold an area in South Australia called Woomera, that's W-O-O-M-E-R-A. They sold this area to Raytheon. It's an area bigger than England that was already a place where I think they detonated some atomic bombs and did stuff like that. But they sold it to Raytheon in order to, so they can make it into the most advanced weapons testing facility in the planet. This is all about their microwaves and electronic warfare and stuff, the technologies that are used for environmental warfare. And so when you look at what happened with the unprecedented bushfire scenario from December and January, it's clear that Raytheon, having this massive presence in Australia, was the single greatest driving force behind how that happened and how it was truly weaponized environmental warfare that can easily happen again this year. Australia's also got a tremendous amount of influence from China in terms of Chinese investors and interests and businesses buying up farms and land and businesses of every different kind and water rights. And it's just unbelievable. And there's even a lot of stuff in the Australian government, like the head of their equivalent of like the CIA resigned last year and gave a report about how China is trying to penetrate into all the different levels of Australia, the government, the legislature, the media, everything, and put in their people or buy off people here. And it seems to be succeeding, but I met a woman who had been in China and said she saw a map of Australia on the wall in a school in China, and it was labeled, and it had Australia. Australia was called New China. And I don't know how you'd write that in Chinese, But that's kind of scary. But I really think that that's really the same fate that New Zealand might be facing too, because there's an extremely large amount of Chinese influence there. So I don't know. Part of my goal and mission is I love to go around and be with the beauty and power of land and nature. And that's what's so amazing about being here in Tasmania. It's like the crown jewel of Australia. It's Australia, but it's not. It's an island almost the size of Ireland, but a fourth of it's completely inaccessible. It's got only not even 500,000 people. And to go to the places I've been and places, hopefully someday I'll be able to get down south to like Cockle Creek and Malaluka, maybe Cox Bight, but I'd really like to honor two of the top Australians that are my true Rachel's Carson of today that are Australian. And I can't list many people from Australia that could qualify as people that truly understood and loved nature and actually did stuff that mattered more than signing a petition or protesting or something like that. Their names, and interestingly, like myself, they were imports from other countries. They were both from Eastern Europe, Peter Dombrovskis and Olegas Troukanis. They were both, they had kind of a father-son relationship back in like the 1970s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and into the 90s. They were both photographers that were also wilderness enthusiasts. Olegas more than Peter. Olegas actually would go out and kayak. He kayaked down the Franklin River. He was the first person ever to do it and came out the other side fine and had his camera. And so they, and Peter Dombrovskis went out with a large format. I think Olegas used 35mm and Dombrovskis used like a 4x5 camera film that he would take out and go out for days at a time with his raft and just do photography. And they both use their photography to share the beauty and power of Tasmania and to try to protect places like Lake Petter and then the Gordon River. And they really created Australia's original environmental movement. And Peter Dombrovskis created the first nature calendars, his photographs of his beautiful scenes of nature and stuff, in which no people ever appear, and he never shoots anything in bright sun. So if you're ever in Hobart, there's a gallery called Wild Tasmania at Salamanca Market, run by a photographer named Rob Blakers, who kind of knew Peter Dombrovskis. But go in there and have a look. It's got some really cool stuff. But I met his widow, Liz, who was publishing his stuff for a long time, but she stopped. But these were the real Australians, the real Tasmanians who truly loved the land, and they weren't obsessed with the social reality or the being cool or being rich or anything like that. And I've really seen that change happen in Australia over the past 10 years. What my friend Robin Shepherd observed, he's a brilliant Kiwi on the North Island, he said the Australians are obsessed with money. And over the past few years, I've really seen that. It's like people make so much money here and have so much. And people from Europe, like 2 or 3 years ago, people from Europe were observing on how expensive everything is here. And it's a form of dementia. And I think that this whole thing over the past 3 months with the coronavirus, it's kind of jerked a knot in people to a degree. But you know, I've seen some people bring out their very best, but I've also seen a lot of people just become even more kind of like selfish and me-first oriented. And so it's quite paradoxical, everything. But, you know, I think that Australia, like New Zealand, because it's isolated island communities that are far removed from the north, that they've been sort of experimental test colonies by psychologists and psychiatrists and military strategic planners from maybe the Tavistock Institute and think tanks in London and places like that, like the Port Arthur shooting in 1996. and that kind of thing, and then these fires, and it's just all. And what Australia and New Zealand both have a very high amount of water fluoridation, and so I think that contributes to the kind of docility of the people. Australia also has overtaken America in terms of a statistical obesity. And I have to admit that yesterday when I went out up into town for the first time in well over a week or more, I really just kind of noticed how fat a lot of the people are, and also kind of how maybe not that bright they seem. I don't mean anything personal, but just kind of Australia is the kind of place in Tasmania, if you can kind of keep to yourself and do your own thing, you can have kind of a laissez-faire scenario like I've really had. So my whole strategy has been, I've made some of my very best friends in the world in Australia, and I try to go and see them and keep in touch, and I've had some of the biggest support for my art from people here in Tasmania, especially, for example, my spiritual brother Rob Alliston, who grew up on Three Hammock Island, and I'm just getting in touch with some people that knew him. He wanted to create kind of a neo-Fentorn-like community out on this little island as part of the hunter group off the northwest coast. And he passed away 2 years ago before he could take me out there, but I'm trying to work on a little film in his honor. But my whole strategy in traveling around is not to connect with the people so much, but to go, not even the indigenous people, but to go directly to the land herself, who are the Dreamtime ancestors, the spirit, the ancestors of the rocks and the trees and the birds, the kookaburras and the black cockatoos and the white cockatoos and the monitors and the beautiful foresters, kangaroos, and the platypus, who I've been able to go and play my flute to just about every day here. The beautiful, oh my God, everybody. It's just such an amazing place. And just right here, there's over 30 different varieties of birds that I sort of hear or see almost every day. That's up there with New Zealand in terms of a bird place. So what I'm doing right now is honoring the beauty and power of being here in the crown chakra of the rainbow serpent, in terms of that being a geotelluric energy being of Australia. And I'm trying to honor the beauty and power of being here now and maintain the sacred connection with ceremony and making my most elaborate medicine wheel and playing my flute on top of Mount William and trying to go to the Tiagara Indigenous Center tomorrow and hopefully make a trip to Mount Amos, this giant granite dome, and hopefully make it out to Three Hammock Island and return to the mainland in the next 2 or 3 weeks, continue my healing journey, traversing song lines old and new, maintaining the sacred connection with life, and visiting these powerful, beautiful places and trying to honor and be with them and give them love. Because so many people, I've come to know Australia and New Zealand far better, not only than just most of the people who live in the countries, but than anyone else possibly could, because I don't know anybody else that has been willing and or able and actually done what I've done, travel around constantly for 20 years all over the continents and the countries and visiting places that I love and visiting my friends and traveling as low impact as possible. What could be lower impact traveling than hitchhiking? Somebody's, you know, it's only possible because people drive, but they're already going that way anyway. I'm not driving my own car. I'm not chartering a flight or a bus or making somebody make a special trip for me. Hitchhiking has to be the most brilliant way to travel, if given that travel is going on, because if you can bring somebody else around, why not? And it instantly increases the efficiency of your resource use and creates beautiful encounters and opportunities for sharing and adventure. So I've tried to boil a 20-year story of my life down into an hour-long radio show. And I've hit a lot of the high points, but I'm working on some books and films about this amazing journey that's going stronger now than ever. But what I'm trying to do is share through my art and my writing and my music and my activism, the beauty and power of Australia, the landscapes, and the unbelievable magic and beauty and power, and to understand the plight of the Indigenous people and to fight the good fight and to carry their torch and their mission. And a lot of the Indigenous people of today, there's a lot of confusion and a lot of complex contradiction and a lot of bickering and infighting among them. And I try to just sort of stay clear of all that and try to do stuff that's in honor of everybody and all life forms. And it's just so beautiful to be here now. I love Australia. And what you're hearing behind us, along with my flute, it's an instrument that's commonly called the didgeridoo. But I learned from my friend Roy Newman, a Bundjalung man from near Byron Bay, who I've met in the year 2000. It's actually called Yidaki. That's Y-I-D-A-K-I, Yidaki. That's from up in the Northern Territory. That's where the instrument originated, and really the only place that it's really from. It sort of probably traveled around Australia after the Europeans came, but it's called Yidaki. So, I guess I should sign off now and go and work on my medicine wheel. This is Jeff Phillips Wafferson signing off from the heart of Tasmania, the crown chakra, the rainbow serpent, and the lucky country, the land down under. I read that the man that came up with that expression back in the 1950s, I forget his name, but he originally wanted Australia to be known as the lazy country. But the PR people weren't going to have that, so they made it into the lucky country. But I can see what he means. It's not just because of the heat. It's kind of the people here have never been... They've never had to ask much of themselves. And Robert Lawler, a very interesting historian and scholar that lives out on King Island, he wrote a very powerful book called Voices of the First Day, Awakening in the Aboriginal Dreamtime. And he has some very interesting insights about the difference between what happened in America with the Indigenous people versus Australia. In America, the founding fathers like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, they embraced the Iroquois Native Americans who already had a long-standing social order based on fundamental rights of people and relationships and stuff. And so they even had it codified. And so they incorporated a lot of the Iroquois Confederacy ideas into the Constitution of the USA. And if it wasn't for the hospitality of the Native Americans, those early colonists would never have survived. Well, here in Australia, the first Europeans to come, well, not the first, because as I understand it, there was French explorers like La Perouse and D'Entrecasteaux. They came and were able to have harmonious interactions with the Indigenous people that didn't result in deaths or killing or genocide or imperialism. They came and understood and shared and were always welcome and invited back, but not when the British came. When the British came, there was death and killing just within a few weeks there at Botany Bay and the enslavement and then the penal colonies and the rampant genocide. And so it's really made me wonder if that was the biggest difference between the French and British cultures. Maybe the world would have been a lot better off if the French had dominated in the way that the British did. Very interesting thing to think about. But the William Ricketts Sanctuary has the true message. I'm trying to be the eyes and ears, traveling around Australia and New Zealand and sharing the beauty and power and the story and the wisdom and maintaining the sacred connection, playing my flute to the sacred mountains and painting on some rocks and making medicine wheels and singing with the birds and playing my flute to the platypus and trying to be of service to the Indigenous people. Like I'm going to be catching up with Auntie Dawn Blaisley. She's an elder woman of Tasmanian Aboriginal descent, and I met her on Flinders Island in 2014. She was out on the island looking for her grandmother's grave, and so I went and helped her. And after 2 days of looking, we found it. And I did a ceremony, made some painted rocks, and we've kept in touch. She's an artist, and now she's going around Tasmania doing healing circles with Indigenous people, and she was going to invite me into that. She's going to come over here, and so I can film an interview with her at her little yarning circle that she designed by the river. And maybe I can go to Launceston and photograph her paintings. So I try to be of service to the Indigenous people any way I can and carry their torch and try to be an Indigenous person myself and bring forth the new dreaming, because that's really what it means to be here now, and such a beautiful gift. So I'm celebrating 20 years down under and hoping we can all do our best to transform Wasichu Koyaanisqatsi into Lolomai Kuakatsi on behalf of, so that the people of one heart of all the kingdoms of life might be nurtured as the seeds of the new creation. This is Jeff Phillips Wiferson signing out from northern Tasmania. G'day, Kaba. I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs from Robert Lawler's book. It's from this chapter 8 called Seed Dreaming. In his book Black War, The Extermination of the Tasmanian Aborigines, Clive Turnbull maintains that many of the British colonists who first stepped off the boats onto Tasmanian soil would today be classified as criminally psychotic. After centuries of colonial atrocities all over the New World, the cycle of seed to fruit reached its peak, and the confrontation between these degenerate colonists and the Tasmanian Aborigines by 1850, the extermination of this primeval people had swept from the earth the last rituals of human innocence. We are blinded by the delusions that rise from our hollow and rotting social order. It is vain pomposity to believe that humanity can advance while the earth and its native peoples, plants, and animals are enslaved, desecrated, and destroyed. The dream of human origins and destiny as an evolution from monkeys swinging in trees to men in spacesuits lumbering off to other planets is an adolescent dream of uninitiated men drunk on the power of the cerebral cortex. Unfortunately, the men who maintain this dream are the ones who hold economic, military, and political power today. Whether it be by socio-political revolution, economic disaster, or environmental catastrophes, the overturning of this power is the only hope for the earth. The change must occur while there is still time to nurture the seed and to prepare ourselves inwardly for the dream of regeneration. It is important to recognize that the Aboriginal way of life retains the seed of human culture. It is of great importance to humanity to retain and protect this seed. The thwarted attempts by Aboriginal leaders and communities to obtain land rights over some of the uninhabited regions of Australia so that they can practice their traditional way of life is a significant issue for our entire civilization. Whether it is with us consciously or unconsciously, whether we proceed gradually or rapidly, the return of the seed, the reestablishment of our basic humanity as well as the sacredness and beauty of nature, is the image of the future to which we should turn. Thank you.